Old Testament reading today is from Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 through 7. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them the light has shined. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders. He is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. The New Testament reading is from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapters 11, 1 through 6, and 16, 13 through 17. Now when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and proclaim his message in their cities. When John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, but others Elijah, and still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." Hear what the Spirit is saying.
Hope, grace, listening, ineffability, love. A brief review of Dr. Peter S. Hawkins' writing will turn up words like these, words that reveal his interest in the things that matter most of all in human life and relationships. Dr. Hawkins has long used the poetry of Dante as a primary source and subject of his exploration, engaging Dante's hell and purgatory and finally heaven with the precision and curiosity of a scholar, but also with the open heart and the passion of a seeker after truth, a seeker after God, a seeker after heaven itself. Among the words that emerge as you review Peter Hawkins' work, one that appears over and again is imagination. He is interested in the ways that human beings encounter and creatively engage life. And just as he describes Dante's scriptural imagination, I think it can safely be said that Dr. Hawkins also engages life and God and questions of what it means to be a human being with his own scriptural imagination, with a poetic imagination. And as an explorer of the sometimes wild and other times manicured and clipped landscape of language, Dr. Hawkins began his academic life at University of Wisconsin at Madison, going on to receive his Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary in New York and his PhD. PhD from Yale. He currently teaches at Yale Divinity School and at Yale College, and it was at Yale that I came to know him when I was there doing my Master of Divinity, now more than 20 years ago. Wells, right? Before teaching at Yale, he's currently serving as professor of religion and literature. He has also taught at Boston University and held fellowships at Oxford, Cambridge, and a school in Genoa whose name's pronunciation I've chosen not to attempt. He just returned from time at the Center for Medieval Studies at the University of York in the UK. Dr. Hawkins has, of course, as a very accomplished scholar and teacher, has published many works, including several on Dante, a primary subject of his research, also including the expanded version of his 2007 Beecher Lectures on Preaching, and a study series that I just discovered that he's co-edited and designed entitled Listening for God. It's a study resource on contemporary literature and the life of faith, Listening for God. And I end on that title because I think that is what Peter Hawkins does. He listens for God in the written texts of our shared faith, in the written texts of poetry and other literature and fiction. And he also listens for God in the lived texts of our contemporary culture and of his own life. Peter is a good listener who helps the rest of us learn to do what he does so well. So now, friends, I have to say I have been waiting for months to have this honor and this privilege to welcome my friend and my teacher, Dr. Peter S. Hawkins, to the Foundry pulpit. Let's open our hearts and our minds to receive the gift that he brings us.
Surely it wasn't 20 years ago when she was a student. In one of his letters from a Nazi prison, dated roughly a year before his death in April of 1945, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote to a friend, "Who is Jesus Christ for us today?" Now, posed by somebody else, or even by Bonhoeffer under different circumstances, such a question might seem merely rhetorical, one that had a ready answer, one that was already known, like the worn smooth response in a catechism. Worse yet, the question might even seem like a visiting preacher's sermon title. But the fact that Bonhoeffer asked it from prison, in the face of certain death, means that there was nothing merely rhetorical about it. This gets scary for a moment, but let's pretend that he's asking it of us. On a day when Foundry Church is welcoming new members, how might we answer him? Now, surely it wouldn't be with church speak or with anything secondhand. The traditional formulations of the ancient creeds, he already knew them. And they wouldn't really speak to his present need, no matter what the truth. Nor would the controversies of modern theology, which he knew all too well, with their inevitable spinning of intellectual wheels. No. When Bonhoeffer wrote his letter and posed his question, he was in crisis. Any minute there would be the knock on the cell door, the transport to the concentration camp at Buchenwald, and finally the walk to the gallows at Flossenburg. He knew that his end was near, and therefore he needed an answer, and he needed it now. Who is Jesus Christ for us today? Well, as we've heard, roughly 2,000 years ago, John the Baptist posed more or less the same question to Jesus' followers, and like Bonhoeffer, he did so from prison. He wanted them to ask the new rabbi, and I quote from Mark, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to await another?" In this case, the questioner was no scholarly pastoral theologian, but a fire and brimstone preacher impatient for Israel's ancient prophecy to be fulfilled, impatient for a deliverer who would enlighten the land of deep darkness that Isaiah spoke about, darkness in which he and his people lived. I think we know something about that darkness. In Herod's jail and under the sentence of death, John embodied centuries of messianic expectation, and with it, centuries of impatience. How long, O Lord? How long? Stuck behind bars, he had to send other people running. There was no time to waste. He needed to know if today was the day, if Jesus was the one. If ever there were an occasion for a direct yes, this would have been it. But instead of answering straight on, Jesus points away from himself, points toward the world that he and John share, a world in which the blind have come to see, the deaf to hear, the lame to walk, and the dead to live. Rather than say who he is, in other words, he points instead to what has happened because of him. Is this a very sly way of laying claim to messianic identity without claiming it outright? Probably. But his turning away from himself to others also suggests something more. If you want to know who Jesus is, you must first see and hear and feel him in the world around you wherever there is healing taking place. Who is Jesus Christ for us today? Well, he is the restoration of sight, of hearing, of mobility, of life. There is simply no proper noun that will sum him up. He is all action verbs. But maybe he's also the question itself, the one that keeps on being posed and for which no answer is finally adequate. Why else, after all, would each of the synoptic gospels, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, place at their center the moment when Jesus asks his disciples who they think he is? By this point in their time together, so much had already happened. I mean, miracles of every kind, sermons on the mount and in the plain, conflicts with religious leaders, powerful demonstrations of spiritual authority. And yet, after all of this, as the disciples make their way toward yet another village in Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asks them not only what strangers think he's all about, but what they make of him. It's all very well that some in the crowd think he's John the Baptist come back from the dead, or from centuries before Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the other prophets, but he insists on going personal. But who do you say that I am? This point-blank question is, of course, meant to put them on the spot and to provoke an honest response. When Peter gives it, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," he offers the answer on which the church is built. But just as vital as that answer is, I think, the question. But who do you say that I am? important that Jesus asks this not at the beginning of his relationship with the disciples, but well down the road. Indeed, not far from the end of that road. It's as if to know who Jesus is means having to ask about him again and again. It means accepting the fact that you can never quite get him. It means acknowledging your need to know him for yourself and today. And maybe it also means asking the question of his identity outside of church. Asking it in prison, on the road, in a hospital corridor, on the metro. Asking it any place where you find yourself in need and at a loss. Any place where the answers aren't already lined up in size place, waiting for you to neatly choose among them. It may mean that you need to step out of line, away from piety, at a distance from all the received wisdom you've ever heard. What if, perhaps only for a moment, you let go of the bearded man you see in all the windows? What if you let go of the personal Lord and Savior you could never quite get into your heart, no matter how hard you tried? What if you put to the side, respectfully, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, Christ the King, Christ the Liberator, the one who is named Wonderful Counselor, the Prince of Peace, the Man of Sorrows, even Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Man for Others? What if you risked asking Bonhoeffer's question for yourself? Who is Jesus Christ for me today? Given the way we're built, it's most likely that you take a risk like this when you're driven to it. In prison, in the corridor outside a beloved's hospital room, in your own hospital room. And yet, it doesn't have to be the dire situation that can make you bold, bold enough to ask the biggest questions without expecting the familiar answers. Sometimes a moment of truth comes in the middle of ordinary time, like a late summer Sunday. Take my experience, for an instance. In the late 1970s, I was at the beginning of my teacher career at Yale Divinity School, and I was visiting New Haven Yale friends who were house-sitting in Stonington, Connecticut. Our absent host was the poet James Merrill, a friend of my friend's, who was in the process of writing what would become, by 1982, a three-part, 560-page epic poem, The Changing Light at Sandover. Crucial to its composition was a homemade Ouija board that became the stage for serious sessions of play undertaken by Merrill and his partner, David Jackson, not only on their own, but often in the company of friends. Together, the two men, plying the improvised board with an inverted blue willow teacup, would contact spirits in an afterlife that may only have been their conjoined imaginations. Night by night, and over the course of 40 years, they conjured a community of figures that included favorite poets, parents, deceased friends, a host of other spirits who showed up on the board from, I don't know from where, they just showed up. Whatever one makes of its origins, the monumental poem that emerged is like nothing else in literature. Well, maybe Dante's Divine Comedy comes to mind.
Needless to say, the friends with whom I was visiting, both of whom were poets, took their house sitting as an opportunity to imitate the master. Now, where was that Ouija board? For 3 days of the weekend, I watched the two of them sitting across from one another at Merrill's dining room table. Each touched lightly the upturned teacup, whose handle served as a pointer, or planchette, as it's called, to one place or another on the board. Taking turns, they asked their questions. In response, and to my utter incredulity, the cup shifted subtly, shuffled quickly between vowels and consonants, commas and periods, the words yes and no. One of them took down the barrage of letters and symbols with his spare hand. A line of script that would later be divided into words and sentences. It happened so fast, too fast for me to think that they were able to make it up on the spot, but what else could they be doing? As young poets, my friends predictably brought questions to the Ouija board about the writers they loved, some of whom they managed to contact, or so it seemed. For my sake, the house guest, they asked about Dante. No result. In his case, a door into the afterlife was slammed shut. He was, as the board spelled out, too high. Now, if this was the unconscious taking over, it was definitely better than anything we had come up with at the Yale Graduate School. But oddly, despite my literary training, my passion for poetry, it was not really about literature that I wanted to know. Throughout the weekend, I watched them, dumbfounded, as an observer. By Sunday evening, I was to leave the next morning, it finally got to be my turn. Didn't I want, they asked, to try the board myself? Of course, for 3 days I've been waiting for the invitation. But I was also fearful of what it would mean for me to put my fingers on that upturned teacup and then let go. Wouldn't this be King Saul and the Witch of Endor all over again? A forbidden consorting with familiar spirits, a defilement with wizards and mediums. We all know how that turned out for King Saul. Besides, what if they ever found out about this at Yale Divinity School? His tenure, goodbye. Beginning to sweat, I sat down at the table, joined one of my friends at the board, put my hands on the blue billow cup, and shut my eyes. After a little while, the cup began to move in slow circles. Without any apparent direction from my friend, with absolutely nothing coming from me, when he said, "Okay, Peter, what do you want to ask?" To my embarrassment, I found that despite 3 days of waiting for my turn, I had not actually formulated anything. I was there on the board, a teacup under my fingers, nothing in mind. Until, all of a sudden, I realized that there was, in fact, only one thing I wanted to ask. A question I had never asked before, which was so deeply buried in me that I was astonished once I heard myself put it into words. It was as if in that moment I was discovering something about myself I didn't know, some hunger. I opened my eyes and I heard myself ask, "Who is Jesus Christ?" The cup stopped tracing circles and then began to dart quickly, as if with a mind of its own, to the letters H-E-I-S-T-H, moving faster and faster until I couldn't keep up with it, but not so fast that my friend playing scribe couldn't copy down the letters and then decipher the message they formed. "Who is Jesus Christ?" I had asked. And the answer? "He is the lens in the dark box." He is the lens in the dark box. Can any good thing come off a Ouija board? I should not previously have thought so, and you may be well be wondering what Ginger had in mind when she asked me to join the Outstanding Creature series this summer. The whole business was the parlor trick of another generation, which had become in the crazy 70s a pastime of poets who were completely out of my league. And yet, one Sunday night, almost 40 years ago, Ginger, with a teacup under my fingers and sweat pouring down my face, my natural skepticism, my Episcopalian rationality, my scriptural trepidation, all met their match. I couldn't dismiss what I had learned about myself, let alone about Jesus Christ, as either the work of demons or mere hoodoo voodoo. Rather, I was taken someplace where I wouldn't otherwise have gone on my own. In fact, I think I was blindsided by the Holy Spirit. Not that I should have been entirely surprised by the weirdness of the context. Because isn't the word of the Lord invariably spoken in impossible situations, in inappropriate places? To an ancient couple, the old woman has a barren womb. In a death valley crowded with very dry bones. To a girl in a nowhere like Nazareth, at a public execution. Is anything too absurd, too embarrassing for the Lord? Or is anything too metaphorical? Are any of Jesus' names, other than mysteries, spelled out in letters, concealed in syllables and symbols? John the Baptist wonders if he is the one who is to come. Peter confesses him in one gospel as the Messiah, in another as the Holy One of God. For others, he was Master, Rabbi, Son of Man, Son of David, Son of God, King of the Jews, the Lily of the Valley, the Bright and Morning Star, the Fairest of 10,000. And what did he call himself? "I am the bread that comes down from heaven. I am the light of the world. I am the way, the truth, and the life." But for me, having asked who is Jesus Christ in a highly improbable and unforgettable setting, he is first and foremost the lens in the dark box. He is the imaginable focus who enables me to imagine the unimaginable God. He is the human prism in whom the transcendent light becomes a set of shoulders, overturning the table of money changers, a finger writing in the dust, a back being scourged, a voice in extremis crying out the words of a psalm. He is an aperture, an opening up to the darkness. He is at once question and God's answer. He is the lens in the dark box. But who do you say that he is? Who is Jesus Christ today?